join the Patreon to join the conversation. I have so many amazing guests on here that you're probably already following on Instagram or TikTok. So you might as well jump on here and talk to us, ask your very own questions, and you can get access to one-on-one coaching with me through the Patreon. Sign up. The link is in the show notes.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today I have back on the podcast Laura, also known as the OT Butterfly. I will let her reintroduce herself, and then we'll get right into our conversation about vestibular processing. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Chaz, and all parents listening, parents, teachers, everyone listening. It's good to be back. I'm so excited to talk about a very specific niche topic today within my subspecialty within sensory processing. If you don't know me, I am a pediatric occupational therapist, and I work with children ages 3 to 12 on sensory processing challenges, and I coach parents on how to understand their children's sensory processing needs and how sensory processing can really impact learning and behavior. And I am also one of you. I have a child who is, she's almost 4 now, and she has sensory processing disorder and anxiety. So I wear both the parent hat and the OT hat. So I completely get it from both perspectives. And I am ready to tell you all about vestibular input today.
Okay. So let's just go ahead and ask the question. What is vestibular input?
All right. So vestibular is one of the 8 senses that our body processes. A lot of people who aren't in the OT or educational world don't think of us as having 8 senses. They probably think of the most common 5 senses. However, there are 8, and one of those extra senses is vestibular. And vestibular, in a more common term, is what we call movement. It's movement processing, but it's particular to your head. So the vestibular receptors are located in your inner ear, and it gets activated anytime your head is moved out of the upright position in gravity and anytime it moves through space against gravity. So it tells your brain when you're moving fast, when you're moving slow, anytime your head is tilted to the left or to the right, if you're upside down, if you're spinning. It is the sense that alerts you when you're on an airplane and the shutters are down and you know that you are tilting to the left or to the right, even without seeing the visual input from the horizon or for buildings. You can just tell. That is your vestibular system that's activated, and that's located in your inner ear.
And how does that relate to children?
So the vestibular sense is the first sense to be developed in utero, and it is considered to be fully developed, at least most functionally developed, within the 5th month of gestation, actually. So because they're floating in that fluid and they're feeling mommy rock side to side as she's walking and then when she's laying down. So our little babies, even inside our tummies, have their vestibular system already working and activated and starting to process all of that input. The thing about vestibular input, as I mentioned, it's the receptors are in your inner ear. It's not just thinking about movement as in swinging and spinning. The vestibular sense, a refined, well-developed vestibular system, contributes to postural control. So that has to do with sitting upright. And it contributes to balance, to gross motor skills like bilateral coordination. It contributes to visual processing. It contributes to spatial awareness, so being aware of where your body is in space. It contributes to so much. Also, it contributes to arousal and attention and focus. So all of these things that our kids need to play with toys, to navigate their environment, to tolerate movement and play with kids on the playground, and climb play structures And even something as little as getting your hair washed in the bathtub. This is one of the first questions I ask parents when they say their child is having a hard time getting their hair washed. Actually, some kids are not sensitive to the water, but it's tipping their head back in the bathtub to rinse their head off. That slight inversion to a child who is extremely sensitive to vestibular input might have a sense of them falling back, and it triggers their fight or flight response, their protective response. And so they look like they just dislike the bath or hate getting their hair washed. But if you dig deeper, and this is a child with vestibular processing challenges, chances are it has to do with the head tipping back. So there's a lot of very subtle things, but vestibular is all around us, and we would not be able to function appropriately if our vestibular system was kind of inefficient or out of whack.
So how do you help that child who is very sensitive to vestibular input, and would they tilt their head back, you know, notice they're having a big reaction? How do you help that child? How do you navigate those challenges with that child?
So when we're talking about vestibular sensitivity and how you can support them, there's going to be the answer for OTs, which they will do, sensory-based integration in the clinic. And it's a lot of movement work, and it's a lot of very trained observations that the clinician is going to have to do to help provide that child with movement that helps them process the vestibular input a little bit more effectively. There's also the answer that I give parents on how you can get through your day with all of the vestibular input without overwhelming your child, and also not avoiding it completely. Because if you have a child who dislikes swings and cries every time they go on a play structure, you might avoid those things because you think they don't like it. It's too hard for you to do it. There's some tasks as a parent that are non-negotiable, like washing your hair. So you have to do it. Now, these are tasks where you need to do this for your child for hygiene, to wash their hair, but you also want to do your best to avoid the fight or flight response. Because every time that protective response is triggered, the more your brain learns to fear that activity that it's now associated with. So that's the tricky part with sensory sensitive kids. They're coming at it from a sensitivity from a neurological basis. Their brain is over-responding, is overly sensitive to the feeling of moving their head back, let's say in the bathtub. But the more often we have to do it, and we have to, quote, force our child to do it because we need to wash their hair, then they're pairing the negative association with the bath. And so now we've got this underlying sensory modulation challenge where they are just inherently fearful of the feeling of tipping back, plus the constant negative association of having to do it. And that makes it really hard to break that. Now, that sensory regulation piece that I talked about, that's what an OT is going to help you with. If you have a child who has significant sensory processing challenges, in-person OT and sensory integration is going to help with that. But you can help with that learned avoidance, that learned fear at home, you as the parent. And you can do this by practicing some of these movements in a safe way outside of bath time. So if we're thinking about tipping our head back, we would want to do it in slow instances where you can offer games that they can practice that same motion. So one of my favorite things is getting a small yoga ball, an exercise ball that the child can sit on, and they can be supported with the ball behind their back, and they would tip backwards and reach a stuffed animal and then sit up and put it in a basket, throw it at a target. Now, the thing with this is, you want to make sure that the child is in control. You want to make sure that you count down so you're not going to surprise them and rolling them back. You might say 3, 2, 1, ready, roll. And you might facilitate, help them roll back in a slow and controlled way. And then always check in with your child. If they feel a little bit overwhelmed, if that was too hard, take a break. And this is definitely a slow process. The other thing I will say is, when it relates to something like bath time or something that's a non-negotiable that you have to do very often, you want to try to role play that and practice that outside of bath time. So if sometimes the fear associated with bath it generalizes to the entire environment of the bathroom. And then you have a child who's afraid of the bathroom. So then I try to ask parents and try to encourage them to build more positive associations with the bathroom and the bathtub. Play Legos in the bathtub without water. Just getting in the bathtub and out of the bathtub. For some kids, this is really necessary to start here because they have such an increased alert and fear once they enter anywhere near the bathtub if they've had so many times of having that fear response in the bathtub. So a lot of parents don't think to do that because it feels silly and awkward to play with your kid in the bathtub without water. But if you think about it, the more positive associations you can build with that environment that has caused them stress and fear can be helpful. And this applies to all vestibular input at swings, on the playground. Slow and gradual exposure can really help them avoid the fight or flight response.
You mentioned earlier that there are 8 senses. Could you off the top name what those 8 senses are?
Yes. So the 5 main ones that we all think about are sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So those are the 5 senses that we most commonly think about. Then there's the vestibular sense, which I said is activated in your inner ear and is responsible for telling your brain where your head is in space. And then there's the proprioceptive sense, which is what we call heavy work. And this is all input to your muscles, to your tendons, and to your joints, and it's active resistance to them. This tells you where your body is in space, all your entire body. So your vestibular sense is limited to your head. Proprioceptive sense is your entire body, your limbs, everything that has muscles, tendons, and joints. And then the last one is interoception. It's the most new sense that is gaining a lot of research. And this is input to your internal organs and sensation. So this is responsible for knowing your body temperature, for knowing when you have to go to the bathroom, if you're hungry, if you're thirsty. And it's also highly linked to your sensations of your emotions, your heart beating fast, and the butterflies in your tummy. And so you can also be sensitive to that input, meaning that you maybe have a low tolerance for internal pain. You're very sensitive to those kinds of things, or you could also be under responsive and not really understand or have the right cues for when you're hungry, thirsty, have to go to the bathroom, or have a good sense of your awareness. And so a lot of mindfulness practices target this interoception sense.
Great. Let's switch to some of the questions. Let's get to one question right now. Someone from the community asked, they knew that you were coming and they wanted to ask you this question. So let's read it out. Kate asked, "Hi, my son is definitely sensory seeking. We're currently about to move from an apartment to a house. We're looking into indoor swings. What are your thoughts on this? Also, is it a bad thing to let them spin too much? Lal, we're trying to find ways to get all of the sensory input, but sometimes we run out of ideas. Thank you."
I love you reading out the lol. That's the best part. So let's peel it back. So a sensory seeker, this parent knows her child is a sensory seeker. If you are listening and you don't know what that means, I like to think of all the sensory profiles. There's 3 main ones when we're talking about sensory modulation and how you respond to sensory input. And I like to think of them as sizes of cups. When we think of someone who's regulated, they have a cup with just a just right amount of liquid in it, like middle. If a cup is too empty, dysregulated. If a cup is too full and overflowing, dysregulated. So a sensory sensitive child would have a small sensory cup. So it gets overflowed very fast and they get dysregulated. A sensory seeker, they have a large sensory cup for movement. And I also imagine the cup to have a hole in it. So the more you fill it, the more they need. You just cannot get this cup full. So sensory seekers will just not stop moving, rocking around, moving their head. Maybe they're fidgeting, they're swinging. They will find a way to get the input. And by the way, side note, you can have a mixed threshold which I know a question coming up is related to that, meaning you can have a large sensory cup for movement, but a small sensory cup for sound. You can mix and match all day long with any different kind of profile. You can also have a large sensory cup for spinning, but a small sensory cup for swinging front and back. And those are both vestibular inputs. They're just different. So this mom who's asking a question about her child who's a sensory seeker. So yes, I highly recommend if you are moving to a house and you can have space and you have the liberty to drill into the ceiling and make all of the adjustments, I highly recommend getting swings. I wish I could do that. We're moving into a house, but we're renting. I don't think we'll be able to drill holes into the ceiling, but I love swings for everyone. Even if you are not a sensory seeker, it's so good for kids to have this kind of movement. So if you can do that, yes. I don't have particular brands that I'm tied to. You can search. I know there's some on Amazon. I don't know the quality of them or the durability of them. But there's a lot of sensory swings that you can search that will be great for your seeker. I would look for one that you can suspend from the ceiling because that usually is what will give you that spinning motion if your child wants to spin. So now your second question about should I let my child spin or should I stop them from spinning? So the thing with spinning, especially for a sensory seeker, remember I said there's a hole in their cup. It's very common for sensory seekers, especially movement seekers, to get more dysregulated the more input they get if it's not structured and if it's not goal directed. So what I mean by that is, this is an example that I always get. I had a client who had a large outdoor trampoline and her son would just go out and jump on the trampoline for like 45 minutes after school and would come inside and be buzzing around the house, knocking things over super loud. And mom is like, This seems way more dysregulated than you started before you got on the trampoline. Why are you still like this? And so that trampoline provides vestibular input by jumping up and down, but there wasn't really any structure or goal to it. And this applies to swinging and spinning as well. So what I recommend and how I can tailor that to have structure and goal is I would say, can you jump and do your spelling words? Every time you jump, you say a letter to spell. Or let's try freeze dance. Put on a song, and when the song stops, then you freeze. So having kind of an instruction to go with it, so it's not just endless, mindless kind of sensory input, will really help almost put a tape on that hole on their sensory cup while they fill it up. It will help a lot. The other tip is to do a start and stop component specifically for sensory seekers. So time limits, counting up to 10 and then freeze. You really need to almost let their brain catch up and like think about how much sensory input you got. Let's process that for 30 seconds while we sit still. Okay, now you can go. So start and stop is really, really integral for vestibular seekers. And for spinning, the last thing I'll say is I always limit spinning in one direction 10 times, and then you want to spin the other direction 10 times. Because the vestibular receptors are in your inner ear, there's two sides to it, and they have to be evened out. There's actually a lot of kids who are more dizzy spinning to the right than they are to the left or vice versa. So they can tolerate usually one side better than the other. And you do want those sides to be balanced. So a way to do this is whatever your child is spinning on, let's say it's a computer chair, set up something you want to sort. Legos or stuffed animals on this side and two buckets on the other side. Maybe one bucket is for land animals, the other bucket is for sea animals. And then they would spin to grab one, spin around and drop it in the bucket, spin back around. So there's the goal directed, there's the purpose, there's the start and stop, and they're getting their input. You're going to have much more quality engagement and much more chance of having a regulated child while they're still getting that input. Now, my last little disclaimer is that Of course, it's not always possible for you to monitor every single movement activity with your child. And as a parent, I know there's times where I want her to swing in her swing and I don't want to be structuring it or playing teacher or playing therapist. 100% I get that. But if you can try a couple times a week, or if you have an OT to ask them to help with this, the more you teach your child about their sensory cup and what helps their body and point it out in objective ways, the more they'll become independent in understanding how their body works, and they will become better at self-monitoring what is regulating to them and what is dysregulating to them. So it's, you don't have to do this 100%, but it's an important thing for you to start teaching them, and maybe every once in a while work it into your playtime with your child.
And maybe for the example where you said that the child is out jumping on the trampoline for 45 minutes straight and then comes in and is like, you know, buzzing all around the house, maybe you do allow for, because I imagine that's great time, that 45 minutes is great time for the parents. You know, they have time, they're out there, the children are out, they're good doing their thing, we're inside, I'm good doing my thing, having my peace. But I imagine that you could also go maybe towards the end, maybe 45, maybe 40 minutes, they're jumping. And then as you're kind of helping them transition from outside energy, and because it's fine when they're jumping on the trampoline and they're dysregulated and they're all crazy, like, it's fine. Like, they're in the place to do that, right? It's just becomes more of a problem once it's inside and there are things that can be broken, and there's they can't, you know, throw their bodies with reckless abandon as they would on a trampoline. So maybe at the end, like the last 5 or 10 minutes, you do something kind of goal directed. And so that way they have time to start regulating their bodies and helping you even transition. I even imagine that the actual transition of getting them inside can be goal directed too.
Absolutely. So that way
the child is getting, you know, all their needs met and they're getting their exercise. Everyone is getting their independent time. And then also we're able to successfully transition the child into an environment where our expectations are different than out on the trampoline.
Yeah. And the other thing about that is the thing that I tell parents with this is you can use this information that there's going to be some days where you don't care if your child comes in more dysregulated or not, because you've had a day, it's going to be bedtime anyway, it doesn't matter. But if you know, we're going to a birthday party later, or we have family coming over and I really need them a little bit more regulated, then if you have this in mind, I know when they jump on the trampoline for 45 minutes without structure, they come in a little bit more dysregulated. So I better offer something more structured today. So the more that you understand your child and what these activities and how to adjust them and accommodate to them, you can save those for days when you really need it. Like, there's days where I go into it, I know my daughter, like, this is a trigger. I also don't have the mental capacity or energy right now to intervene with that or to do something special or to structure it. But I know after that, she might have a fallout. She might have a meltdown. She might be dysregulated. It's also a Tuesday. It doesn't matter. We don't have anything big going on. I'll deal with it later. It's more effort for me to do something up front. I completely get that from a parent standpoint, but you can still use this in your toolbox in terms of like informing how you structure your child's day on those other bigger days when there's something that you need them to be like more regulated for.
Not only is it something to help us kind of structure the day to help them be more successful, but it also helps us manage our own expectations about what will happen after certain activities, so that we're not so baffled and frustrated and confused when they do come in and they're knocking everything over. And we're like, what? Like, you were just outside. Why do you have, can you actually talk a little bit more about, because I know I saw you were talking about in your stories about kind of getting the energy out and it's how it's different. Can you talk just a little bit more about that? I know we kind of started the conversation, but share more.
Yeah. So about what it looks like when you're dysregulated with vestibular input. So any sign of dysregulation is going to look different in all children, but there are some general signs specific to movement that I always watch out for, especially when I'm in the clinic and I'm working with a sensory seeker and they could just spin and spin and spin and spin for hours. There is something that's called a post-rotary nystagmus, and this is in your eyes. So anytime you spin and you look at someone after they spin, you'll see their eyes kind of bounce back and forth, right? There is a general window, a range of how many cycles per second or per like 10 seconds, I think, that is considered within normal limits or average. If you display too much nystagmus, for a certain period of spinning, that means you respond too much. You're too sensitive. If you don't have any nystagmus or very little for a lot of spinning, that means you're really not noticing the movement. And that's what we want your body to do. It's okay for kids to feel dizzy. We don't want them to feel way too dizzy, but we don't want them to ever not experience being dizzy, because being dizzy tells your brain how to reorient yourself, and it tells you how to balance yourself. I've worked with kids who have spun for like 20 rotations super fast, and I've barely seen their eyes move after, which I'm like, whoa, and they don't even feel dizzy. I would work all session on clients having them spin, and then sometimes I'm like, they're like, I think I'm dizzy, and they did not even know what dizzy felt like. So those kinds of things I definitely save for in the clinic. When you're working on spinning with a client who's a sensory seeker, you definitely want to be working closely with an OT for that, for to make sure that they are watching out for the right signs. But at home, and when you're at the playground with your child and you're watching them spin, one of the most subtle signs that I think parents don't understand and non-OTs don't understand is that there's this uncontrollable, like, shrieking laughter sometimes that kids have. And if you know, you know, if you've ever heard this, it's like out of control, shrieking, laughing, like constant. And it's just going. When they're spinning usually is when it comes out. And parents or caregivers think like, oh my God, they think this is so fun. Let's keep going. But that's a sign of dysregulation. That's when I would stop and freeze and check in with them. I might even have them push down on their head. It's kind of like a reset button, that heavy work, that input to the top of your head kind of takes the dizzies away. Even if they say they don't feel dizzy, the sensory seekers, you have to really watch out for. You have to help them calibrate their vestibular system from an external standpoint, because they're not registering it. Even though they say they're not dizzy, you have to help them check in with their body and stop the vestibular input and then switch rotations if they're spinning. The other signs are dilated pupils. When you see their pupils getting really big, that's a sign of dysregulation. And when I say they're dysregulated, if they're enjoying it and they're liking it, I just say stop and check in. Maybe have them have a sip of water, do like a couple jumping jacks to work in some heavy work, because heavy work helps bring down that level of arousal. And then they can go back. But that start and stop to check in with their body is really necessary, because they don't know their threshold. Unlike a sensory sensitive child who is sensitive to input will tell you when it's too much, a sensory seeker won't really know. And it'll just keep going. It can sometimes give kids headaches later on without even knowing, not an immediate response, but they might have headaches later on in the day. They might have lingering effects later on in the day. Even up to 15 minutes of vestibular input can give you a lasting effect of up to 6 to 8 hours on your brain and your behavior, both positive and negative effects, depending on what they are. So, yeah.
And it almost sounds like the point is to get a little dysregulated within a certain threshold, within a tolerable threshold, and everyone's threshold is different, so that we can practice, our brain can practice kind of regulating and reorientating back to, regulation. What would you say about that? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is that it's important to let our children feel what it feels like to have something be too much or too little. As long as we're right there helping them navigate through that and helping them understand what that is and showing them how you can combat that, how you can cope with that, how you can then help them get back to becoming regulated. I would say that I would be careful in saying that you want to trigger too much dysregulation, of course. But I think it's more about allowing our children to experience different sensations. And for a child who has vestibular processing challenges, they don't feel dizzy. Now, this isn't going to be to tell you to go spin your child until they feel dizzy. But you'd be surprised. It does. I've had a child say that they register feeling dizzy after 30 different spins broken up three times versus 30 different spins really fast that they did not register because their brain didn't really process it. It just like went right over the head and just they didn't feel it.
Let me actually go on to my next question from the community. And if you want to ask questions and hop on, then you join the Patreon and you could always submit questions like the two that I've done today so far. All right. So this one comes from Justin. My son, age 8, displays sensory seeking activities like roughhousing, jumping, and climbing at playgrounds and general hyperactivity. At the same time, he's very sensitive to smell and sounds. Car rides are difficult for him because any tapping, singing, or loud noise caused by his brothers, ages 11, 9, and 6, usually really bothers him and often starts a fight. At night, he experiences bedtime anxiety. Any noise can make him unsettled, and we started laying down next to him until he starts going to sleep, usually about 30 minutes. We tried a weighted blanket, noise machine, giant stuffed animals, and music, but the only thing that makes him feel safe and secure is either mom or dad next to him. So I'm not sure how to understand or help him.
This is such a good question because this is a great example of having a mixed threshold. So you know that your child has a large sensory cup for movement. He likes to climb and jump and do a lot of movement, but he has a small sensory cup for what it sounds for, mostly sound and some of the tapping and stuff. But I know a lot of that has to do with the sibling rivalry stuff in the car that could probably be very intense. But there's a the important thing to know is that, so remember that the vestibular input is located in your inner ear. So it's very, very much functionally and anatomically linked to the auditory system. So it's very common for a child to have auditory and vestibular processing challenges together because when one is impacted, so is the other. And this is also why children with a history of chronic ear infections are more susceptible to vestibular challenges because the illness that they're experiencing in their inner ear and all of that can contribute to how their brain processes vestibular input. So with the things that you've tried at night, the thing to understand is when you have a child who has sound sensitivity or any sensory sensitivity for that matter, their small sensory cup is filling up throughout the day. And so by the time they go to bed, their cup is probably overflowing. And this is when they're probably most dysregulated and can contribute to anxiety. The other thing about nighttime anxiety is there is that attachment part of wanting to be close to mom and dad. So I can't really peel back the layers and say it's just sensory, but looking at it from a big picture, from a sensory perspective as well, sensory and anxiety, especially sensory sensitivity, it's very linked with anxiety. The more anxious you are, the more heightened your senses are. The more heightened your senses are, the more anxious you are because you're anticipating that sound. The other thing is at night when it's so quiet and you hear and you notice all those sounds, if you're very sensitive to sound, you will hear every creak, every hum, every footstep, no matter how far it is. And if you also have auditory discrimination challenges, which is the inability to identify and localize sounds, your brain processes that as danger. I don't know what that sound is. It's dangerous. My heart's racing. I can't stop. I can't turn it off. And so he knows that mom and dad are his co-regulators, and he knows they are the ones that provide him warmth, maybe hugs, things that are regulating his body at that time. So I know you've mentioned you've tried weighted blankets and big stuffed animals and white noise, but it sounds like that's kind of your bedtime you're using that at bedtime. He might need a little bit more regulation strategies throughout his day to empty out from that small sensory cup by doing some calming activity. So he's a little regulated before you get to bedtime, and then put all of these strategies into place where it's not quite working. And he's just really relying on mom and dad at that part. So I want to be sensitive to that there is real bedtime anxiety where mom and dad are going to really be needed to help co-regulate. But you can also try to improve that a little bit by seeing how you can help him regulate throughout the day and managing his sensory cups.
And one more piece, I'm just going to add a thought on the attachment part of the conversation, because more times than not, there's more than one reason for things, for behaviors and, you know, why things are happening. Sounds like you've tried a lot with the bear, the noise machine. One thing that I might add though, to kind of help bridge that attachment connection, is maybe even a part of something that is yours, like a shirt that like might smell like you, and maybe you even add it with, if he is into the stuffed animal, maybe even add it with the stuffed animal and put it on the stuffed animal. And so that way he can not only have something there to hug you, to hug and to hold, but it's something that might remind him of you, or, that smells like you. So that's just one thing that I would add that it may or may not help, but it may help someone out there. Especially for younger children who typically have this challenge a lot and tends to be centered around attachment a lot.
That's a great idea.
I'm going to ask you, I'm going to say a quote and then an anonymous quote. And then I want you to just tell me what your thoughts are on it.
Okay.
Children intuitively know everything they need to do for their body and brains to grow. Sometimes they need our help finding the appropriate way to do it, but children intuitively know.
100% agree with that quote. This ties into the whole behavior is communication piece. Children know what they need. That's what I tell parents when they say, I can't figure out what my kids' triggers are, what my sensory triggers are. I'm like, well, let's see what they like. What are they doing? What are they gravitating towards? What are they avoiding? They know what they need. They know what they don't like. They can't always express it. They can't always say, I need movement. I need to touch this. They don't know. They just do. That is what they naturally do. They explore and they do what they need, what they want, and what they might not want. And yes, it's our job to educate them on how they can appropriately get that input, if it's safe, if it's appropriate, finding alternatives so that they can have a certain input, maybe longer lasting and not just at one time. And also giving them the tools to advocate for themselves, to get those sensory needs and whatever needs and supports that they need throughout the day, so they can advocate with their teachers and friends and get what they need without having to act it out in a way that other kids or parents or other caregivers wouldn't understand. So we give them the tools, the words, the ways to advocate and express what they need.
Do you know who that quote was by?
No.
That was my quote. Now that you agree with it, I can say that was my quote.
Wow, way to put me on the spot. Anonymous quote.
Well, I'm glad you agreed with it, because then I would have had to keep it anonymous. I'm joking. I do want to wrap it up. You've been able to share so much great information in such a short period of time. But I want to give you kind of one more opportunity to share. I will say, someone really just added to it, and I'll just say, because Kim also added in the thread, I too would like to know if there's such thing as spinning too much. Some days my three-year-old doesn't do it at all, and other days he does it a ton. So that's the last bit for my community, and just I'm going to give you the space and as much time as you need to share anything else you want to share about the vestibular system, vestibular input processing.
Yeah, so it really depends on the child. Again, I would look at it more in each situation, in each session of spinning versus a whole day, as long as it's goal directed and there's a start and stop and they're able to check in with their body and you're not noticing them get too dysregulated, then I don't think that there's to say too much in a day for a child. On days when he doesn't need it as much, I would maybe pay attention to that. Why did he not, if he's typically a sensory seeker, why today did he not spin? Did he spin a ton yesterday, or did he get great sleep last night and he's more regulated? Did he get a lot of outdoor time? I would try to get a little bit closer into that and be a detective to see if you can notice a pattern, because you might be able to use that to your advantage. And as for one lasting piece of advice in terms of the vestibular system and sensory processing, kind of has already been said, but it's just to really, really pay attention to your child and how they respond to movement, because this can contribute to a lot of behavioral things, quote, behavioral things that parents have concerns about related to sleep, related to aggression, related to focusing. And you can really notice how they respond to movement on the playground or at home, or if you think about how they were as a baby, there's a lot of things that you can kind of piece together. And if you notice a pattern that the sensory, that they're either seeking too much vestibular input, that you can't keep up with them, that they're dysregulated, or if they can't tolerate it and it's impacting their social interaction on the playground or impacting their ability at home to get through bath time, then definitely seek out some OT support, because OTs are the ones to help you with this piece with sensory integration.
Actually, I have another question. How does it impact focus? I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about how the vestibular system impacts focus.
Yeah, well, so the vestibular input sends signals all over to different parts of the brain. And it's also really highly tied to, so we said auditory system, and it's also really highly tied to the visual system, because there's that reflex that it helps with, that it helps you focus on what's in front of you. So just from a very surface level standpoint, it's easy to understand that if you're constantly seeking a lot of motion and needing to move and moving your head and rocking your body, it makes it really difficult for your, in terms of visual focus, on focusing on what's in front of you and things like that, makes that really hard. Also, if you're so preoccupied with trying to get the movement around and you can't focus, that might be a challenge. Sometimes the vestibular rocking and motion while you're learning something, especially if it's with a rhythmic piece to it and it's something that's predictable and you're maybe learning spelling words or math facts, that's adding to your ability to attend and to focus to it. It just really depends on what that child needs and what they're doing. It could take away from focus. It could help the focus depending on the child as well.
And really, if from what you said before, it's really about observing the child to really figure out how it's impacting them. If it is helping them focus, or if it is something that is taking away from their focus.
Exactly. And being able to be creative with providing solutions for that, rather than just sit still, put your hands in your lap, don't move, right? The only time that we want to really, really quote force or encourage sitting is for meal times. Everything outside of that, if you can be creative and flexible with allowing your child or your student to stand in the back of the room when you're doing circle time, or to stand behind the kids, the last in line, so that they can move more. Anytime you can be creative and lean into their sensory needs is going to be more beneficial to the child and yourself as the caregiver, as the teacher, because they will more likely be regulated and better able to attend and listen to instructions.
Okay, but what could happen? Like, what is the potential harm, and if we don't do that, if we, instead of allowing children to stand up in the back of the classroom or to move while they're learning, they're doing, and what happens if we are really forcing them and wrongly, you need to sit down, like what, then how does that impact them? And how may that impact them short-term and long-term? Are there long-term impacts?
Yeah, so I love this question. So there's the message that it sends to the child, which is the first thing I think of, which is, well, what's wrong with me then? Because I really need to do this. It's like telling a kid, not if you have that itch on your back and you can't scratch it and you're like rubbing against the wall and someone's like, stop scratching. And you're like, oh, I can't. And they're like, it's not itchy. Don't think about it. It's not itchy. Don't do it. Don't do it. And you're like, oh my God, it's so itchy. I can't help it. That's the same thing. They're scratching an itch. And if they're constantly being told to sit still as if they're getting in trouble, they're being punished, then they're internalizing that message as, well, there must be something wrong with me because I'm the only one who needs this and I'm the only one getting in trouble in my class. How come she doesn't need to move? He doesn't need to move and they can sit still. So there's that message. Then there's the message of there's a piece of not allowing them to do their best work because they might need that movement to really focus and attend and to be able to be regulated enough. You can't teach a child something. They're not in a place to accept information and lessons and academic pieces if they're not regulated. You're not going to learn a fact. Like a very extreme example of dysregulation from a fight or flight response, if you're like running for your life away from a bear, which is an extreme example of dysregulation, and someone asks you, hey, what's 5 + 3? Like, you might not even know what that is. Or if they told you a list of like two things, hey, remember apple, milk, bananas, and you're like, what? Like, I'm running for my life. That is an extreme example, but that's what I use to get teachers and parents to understand what it's like to be dysregulated, where you cannot learn bits of information unless your body is regulated. So in addition to the message that it sends to the child, it really is a disservice to them in the classroom and how they aren't going to be able to focus on whatever lesson it is you think you're helping them with if you ask them to sit still.
Hmm. Okay, so question. So what do you think about crisscross applesauce? What are your thoughts about?
I have a lot of thoughts on this because as a mom and as an OT, I often say this, but I am definitely starting to lean away from this. I'm leaning away from the whole body listening type thing. Whole body listening is a very traditional way to think of what it looks like when a child is, quote, listening to a lesson. But through being an OT and having friends who are fidgeters and needing to move, I know so many people who can pay attention to longer lectures and longer pieces of information than I could by knitting and looking down at their hands and still know every single thing that happened in the lesson. It's not always sitting still, crisscross applesauce, looking up. I think sometimes where OTs rush to crisscross applesauce or a switch in the leg position, sometimes we request sidelying legs, is because of the W position, which we're trying to avoid, which is when kids sit with their knees kind of backwards and their legs backwards. And we're trying to address it from a postural standpoint so that they're able to sit up and attend versus have this low posture and this sometimes harmful position, depending on the child, if they're sitting in W position. But if we're talking about sitting during circle time and listening to a story, I don't think it's very conducive to all children to request that they all be crisscross applesauce, hands in your lap, eyes on the teacher. There's certain ways to, I think, say this message in different ways that's more inclusive of all learners. But I know that we're a long way from getting all teachers on board with that kind of piece.
I think we're a long way away from getting all teachers and parents on board with a lot of things, but I'm glad that we have resources like this or like opportunities like this to talk about it and discuss. And, I shared in one of my past videos how I was reading a book and a child got up and said, I don't want to be here anymore. And in that moment, it wasn't what was like, the things that came up in me were my own problems to deal with. I had planned a lesson. I was really excited about what I had planned for them. I had this concern that if, this child didn't sit here in that spot, then the other children would get up and move and then they wouldn't want to do the lesson that I had planned. And if that happens, that's really more reflection on my lesson than that child. The problem is my lesson, not the child, that they all choose to get up and read, books that are accessible to them all throughout the day. So that's one thing to, just to kind of think about. And I remember in that, I didn't say this in the actual video, but I remember he went up and started to read a book, and I was kind of doing my thing, and everyone else was watching and paying attention. And then I moved on to like the next part of the lesson that was more an active, like up and moving. He came right back, and he was completely in it, which told me like that's the way that he learns and receives knowledge and engages. Mm-hmm. Also, many times, you know, there was a long time where I allowed it but didn't realize, like I had heard, like, oh yeah, maybe they're still like paying attention, maybe they're still listening, but really, like, I have had conversations that, like, especially with that particular child that I'm thinking of, where it didn't seem, I didn't think he was like listening or paying attention or retaining what I was talking about because he wasn't there, or the way his body was moving, I had perceived it as him not paying attention or listening, but talking about it later, or even him recalling and bringing it up later, was something that happened often. So I would just, any teachers out there that are going kind of, or in that challenge, or they're in that battle with themselves, like, ooh, like, what do I do if this child doesn't want to be at my circle time? Really, your goal should be to have a circle time that, you know, they do want to come to, you know, a majority of the children. And maybe not every part of every lesson is for every child, and that's okay. And it's okay to provide, you know, some other options that aren't too like overstimulating for the children who may not want to look at the diagram that you drew out the day before.
Exactly.
I just wanted, and another note on that too, for like teachers of young children, that there are many different ways that children can sit and engage and kind of there, even all in a group. And sometimes I know the concern is like, oh, if they don't sit like crisscross applesauce, then there's not going to be enough space. And that's a lesson in itself in terms of navigating the space amongst each other. And yeah, maybe one child does really want to stand. They need to stand. And it's about, you know, kind of having the conversation, reminding and practicing that, like, if you want to stand, that's something you can do, just stand in the back so the people mm-hmm. who want to sit can see. And that's a whole lesson in itself. And that's all I want to say.
Yep. In a dream world, they would have this, make all sensory tools, all alternative seating, have like a lesson in the beginning of the year and make it very, very not as like, well, why does he get to have it? And what is that for? And how come he needs, just a very like, hey, these are tools and they help some kids learn. Sometimes they don't help kids learn. It works different for everyone. But if anybody's free to use this, not just making that child stand out, you could say, you know, making it just more normalized for the entire class will really help.
Yeah, because there might be that child, because here's the thing, that child that stood up and walked away was a child who was more outspoken, spirited, more comfortable in himself to express to advocate for his needs. But there are children in that same group who may not feel that comfort, right? But they still feel that same, you know, discomfort of you know, sitting or being forced to sitting or feeling like they have to sit crisscross applesauce. And meanwhile, like their body's screaming at them, but they're also too fearful to say anything. And how great is it for them to not have to, you know, like to suffer silently because they don't feel comfortable yet, you know, advocating for their own needs. And they know, oh, this is something that I can use or something I can try. And maybe that's something they learn about themselves. Even at a young age, but it's how to help themselves regulate and engage and participate and pay attention. And I remember even in my master's classes that there were people who, and it wasn't an issue, but there were people who like just stood up randomly and just like, they just stood up and it was fine. No one bothered, you know, maybe they walked around the room. It wasn't an issue.
I think I love that they can see other people stand up. And I think it's also important for teachers then to say, so-and-so stands because he wants to learn the lesson. He needs to stand to help him learn it better, to help him understand it better, versus the kids thinking, well, he's standing up because he doesn't want to listen. Like, this is how his body, you could say it in a more positive way, yeah, versus, you know, so-and-so can't sit down. It's too hard for his body to sit down. I would say his brain learns better when he's standing, and that's what his body needed. And he can, and definitely work with that child outside of the circle time instead of in front of everyone, you know, so that he's just a little bit more understood that way.
Yeah, 100%. Well, this is a great conversation, Laura, the OT butterfly.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?